Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and today I'm joined by Dr. Richard Jenkins, Vice President of Medical Services and Chief Medical Officer for Emirates, one of the world's leading airlines. Richard is an accomplished and globally minded group medical director and CMO with a prestigious reputation across the United Kingdom and international healthcare sectors for clinical and organizational governance. He also has extensive experience in leading sustainable growth and delivering outstanding patient care, while additionally finding time to contribute to world health causes, such as being one of the founding members of the Global Chief Medical Officers Network, an organization I'm proud to be a member of. We're going to discuss all of that, innovation, well-being in the workplace, and the impact of COVID-19 on aviation. So, Richard, welcome.
Jonathan, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here and take part in the podcast.
It's lovely to have you on, and from a chilly day in London to be speaking to you in Dubai, which I'd normally say is sunny, but you tell me it's foggy there. I don't think as we're shivering here in England, we're going to feel too badly for you.
No.
So let's start at the beginning. You undertook your medical training at King's College in London, and alongside this, you completed an intercalated degree in psychology at University College London. What drove you to do that double track, and how has it impacted your future career, if at all?
I think psychology has always been of great interest to me, both psychology and you know, going through training and as a younger doctor, psychiatry as well. And that interface between physical health, mental health, and also the interface between health and human behavior has always been something that I've had an interest in. And I think it's extremely important in relation to what we do day to day as clinicians, both patient-facing clinicians and executive or occupational business-based clinicians. So it was UCL offered an interesting intercalated psychology that was focused, as you can imagine, more towards the clinical aspects of psychology. So we did a lot of neuropsychology, psychology of sight, of hearing, taking it forward. It's continued to fuel a passion in me to really never forget that whilst we deal with a lot of physical health and people's health and well-being in the workplace, fundamentally behind all of it is a requirement to be aware of and to focus on people's psychological health, whether that be through formal psychology or formal psychiatry, or just supporting people in making good choices, behaviors, that kind of activity.
So yes, absolutely. There's that aspect of it, but you know, as you were answering, Richard, I'm thinking through an expression I like to use is there's two elements to a sickness. There's the disease itself, and then there's the dis-ease. There's the, you know, the concern, that pit in your stomach that because you're dealing with a physical issue. And I think as doctors, number one, I don't think most of us are particularly well trained to deal with it, and quite frankly, you know, let's say you have a coronary artery occlusion and it's dealt with by an angioplasty, a stent, whatever. But then there's that nagging doubt in the person, in the back of the person's mind about their future health and their impending mortality. And we need to do a better job of that, don't we?
I agree. And I think I know we'll probably touch on aviation later, but I think in all occupations, and in particular those occupations that require you to have a certain level of fitness, both physical and mental, that nagging doubt is amplified because it's intricately linked to your livelihood. So I think people have doubts about their personal health, and then what does that mean in terms of me, my family, and one of the things that we focus on a lot in Emirates, and I know others in chief medical officer roles in industry is how does that fear and doubt sort of translate into what does this mean for me as an employee, right, and what risks does it pose for me for my future livelihood in the workplace? And those are real risks and real fears that people carry with them.
Yeah, and we'll come on to the, there are some specifics about aviation that I'd love to drill down to, but boy, you're absolutely right. Let's circle back and cover that more. But I want to go through your history a wee bit first. In the early 2000s, you worked for what was then known as, I believe, the National Health Service Institute for Innovation and Improvement. Bit of a mouthful. I'm fascinated by innovation and the innovation process. So I'd love to know, what was the focus of the organization back then, and what innovation do you think the NHS is crying out for now, especially in the time of COVID?
Yeah, I agree. It was a bit of a mouthful. I mean, they shortened it down to NHSII. And at the time, it was one of the arm's length bodies that was run from a central department. Based at the University of Warwick, on the campus there in Coventry. And it was a collection of clinicians and innovation and improvement specialists and those with an interest in order to give a steer both to national policy level, but also a practical support at the coalface level of how people can think about innovation, think about improvement, but also how can they upskill their innovation and improvement. I think we often talk about innovation and sort of expect it to be this natural thing, but it's like everything else. It's better if you receive training, and it's better if you practice. So within the team that I was involved in, we had three main streams. One was improvement skills, one was patient safety, and the third was leadership. And the improvement skills came first because they really underpin everything else. And it was around understanding what level of capability is there in the NHS. And we looked at all sectors, acute, community, primary care, and we also looked separately at mental health and psychiatry. Within the clinical workspace in particular, but also in some of the management workspace and the C-suite space, do people actually know how to undertake basic levels of improvement? So do they know any lean techniques? Do they know any structured framework in which to operate through an improvement project? And aligned with that is the use of data and the use of metrics. And as you know, to know if something's an improvement, you've got to know what it was before and what it was after. And as obvious as that sounds, it's a significant gap in people's improvement projects. And they say, I've done this project, and you say, that's great. And there was no measurement at the beginning. And so even if you did measure at the end, it's slightly irrelevant. So we focused on run charts, statistical process control charts, some basic lean and some basic methodologies. And that was around awareness and some teaching. With the safety aspect, we developed a program called Leading Improvement in Patient Safety. It sort of spawned from the Institute for Healthcare Improvement Patient Safety program in the US. And we had programs for acute hospitals, for primary care, and for psychiatry. And they were five-day residential programs where a team from that unit would come, and the team would normally be someone like the nurse director, the clinical director. We normally ask for the chief executive. We would like the finance director, because you can't really do anything without knowing about the money. And then a couple of clinicians, both nurses and doctors. And again, we would go through particular aspects of patient safety, but in a deliberate improvement manner. So we used trigger tool methodologies for assessing risk. We used human factor teaching, how do we make errors? Why do we make errors? And actually getting into the science of patient safety and the science of improvement to give people techniques to take away. And the final aspect that I was involved in was leadership. Most of that was through something called the Innovations Program. And we would twice a year take teams of executives, normally from quite big institutions, so either teaching hospitals or very large county type hospitals, but also PCTs, and they would be the
just for the benefit of anyone. That's there's a lot of acronyms. PCT is a primary care trust, so it's a group of, if you will, general practitioners and the patients that they speak to. Correct.
Correct. And within all these teams, we'd essentially take, as before, the directors and the leadership teams, and usually a chair. And we would take them over to Boston in Massachusetts, and we had a very close working relationship with a few of the big units over there. So Massachusetts General, MGH, Beth Israel Deaconess, and the Partners Network of Primary Care facilities within the Boston and the Massachusetts area. And we would immerse them in and partner them with an improvement project in the US. And then they would spend the next 6 months back in the UK maintaining that relationship with their US counterparts as they worked through the improvement project back home. And that was a successful program that ran for several years.
Can you think of one specific activity? I'm sorry to put you on the spot like this, but a specific activity that flowed from that work?
From the leadership?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm intrigued, you know, having practiced on both sides of the duck pond, I'm intrigued by acceptability and people seeing eye to eye on how to deal with a specific issue.
It was. One of the things that we found very interesting was the perceived and I think it was a genuine higher focus of the US institutions on listening to their what they would call a customer client base as well as a patient base, and guiding and delivering based on that. So to give you an example, one of the MRI facilities that MGH ran, they would run 24 hours a day, and they would offer faster access and lower cost access if you went through the early hours of the morning, as an example. So that thought process around not just delivering something expecting patients to come, but listening to the patients and saying, what is it that we can do to make it easier for you? Because as you know, Jonathan, in the US, you've got a choice agenda, and that's not necessarily a bad thing in healthcare, to make people think, why would somebody come to me as opposed to coming to the hospital down the road? And that listening and actively going out to your patient base and saying, how can we make this better for you so that you would choose us? And you know, the UK did the family and friends, and I guess that's a similar aspect. But we found that was quite powerful, and a lot of the leadership teams took that back with them.
Interesting. Well, when I first went to the United States, I was actually astonished to see how similar it was to the United Kingdom, rather than how there were more similarities than differences. But anyway, after your work with the National Health Service, that particular entity, moving to Dubai and specifically to Emirates, what attracted you to that challenge? And also socially, what's it like to live in Dubai for those who haven't been?
For those who haven't been, that they should come. So I bridged the gap with a 3-year period in a company in Yorkshire called One Medical Group, which was a private company, for-profit private company that contracted back into the NHS. So we would competitively tender for NHS contracts, whether those were urgent care centres, GP practices, that kind of thing. And the other arm of the business was healthcare property. So we would build mainly GP centers, but also urgent care centers and sort of one-stop shop community type health centers, either on contract with the NHS or on contract with general practices, and then operated on a sale and lease back. So that sort of bridged my NHS into the private sector. And then I was approached and offered the opportunity at Emirates. And like most things, there's a lot of reasons not to make big changes like that. But things sort of ducks came into a row. It was the right time for the children to move them in school without being disruptive. My wife has grew up and spent her childhood around the world. Her dad was an oil tanker captain, so always had that sort of yearning that we shouldn't just spend all our time in the UK. And it just looked right. It was interesting. They were looking for, at that point of time, somebody to turn around what had started off as a very organic one or two doctors just supporting a fledgling airline into what was turning into what is now the world's biggest international airline and a significant health service that supports it. They were interested in making significant changes. They were definitely interested in making the service more efficient and leaner. And all of the things that, I guess, whilst working for the NHS Institute, you teaching other people, it was the opportunity to take some of that and put it into practice. And it was something different. I've always thought we can, as GPs in particular, you can spend your days in the same practice, and that was never something that I intended to do, and it was just the opportunity, and we took it.
Well, having had the privilege of